A dirty brick building in Cambridge housed the offices of Image Eye Studios. The business offices were on the fourth floor, a suite of two studios were on the fifth, and a poorly air-conditioned screening room, only big enough to hold 16 seats in rows of four, was on the sixth and top floor. On that early Monday evening, Vic Trenton and Roger Breakstone sat in the third row of the screening room, jackets off, ties pulled down. They had watched the kinescopes of the Sharp Serial Professor commercials five times each. There were exactly 20 of them. Of the 20, three were the infamous Red Raspberry Zingers spots. The last reel of six spots had finished half an hour ago, and the projectionist had called goodnight and gone to his evening job, which was running films at the Orson Welles Cinema. 15 minutes later, Rob Martin, the president of Image Eye, had bade them a glum good night, adding that his door would be open to them all day tomorrow and Wednesday if they needed him. He avoided what was in all three of their minds. The doors'll be open if you think of something worth talking about. Rob had every right to look glum. He was a Vietnam vet who had lost a leg in the Tet Offensive. He had opened IE Studios in late 1970 with his disability money and a lot of help from his in-laws. The studio had gasped and struggled along since then, mostly catching crumbs from that well-stocked media table at which the larger Boston studios banqueted. Vic and Roger had been taken with him because he reminded them of themselves in a way, struggling to make a go of it, to get up to that fabled corner and turn it. And, of course, Boston was good because it was an easier commute than New York. In the last 16 months, Image Eye had taken off. Rob had been able to use the fact that his studio was doing the sharp spots to land other business, and for the first time, things had looked solid. In May, just before the serial had hit the fan, he sent Vic and Roger a postcard showing a Boston T-bus going away. On the back were four lovely ladies, bent over to show their fannies, which were encased in designer jeans. Written on the back of the card, tabloid style, was this message: Image Eye lands contract to do butts for Boston buses. Bills big bucks. Funny, then. Not such a hoot now. Since the Zingers fiasco, two clients, including Cannes Look Jeans, had canceled their arrangements with IE. And if AdWorks lost the Sharp account, Rob would lose other accounts in addition to Sharp. It had left him feeling angry and scared, emotions Vic understood perfectly. They had been sitting and smoking in silence for almost 5 minutes when Roger said in a low voice, "It just makes me want to puke, Vic. I see that guy sitting on his desk and looking out at me like butter wouldn't melt in his mouth, taking a big bite of that cereal with the runny dye in it and saying, 'Nope, nothing wrong here.' And I get sick to my stomach, physically sick to my stomach. I'm glad the projectionist had to go. If I watched them one more time, I'd have to do it with an air sick bag in my lap." He stubbed out his cigarette in the ashtray set into the arm of his chair. He did look ill. His face had a yellowish sheen that Vic didn't like at all. Call it shell shock, combat fatigue, whatever you wanted. But what you meant was scared shitless, backed into a rat hole. It was looking into the dark and seeing something that was going to eat you up. "I kept telling myself," Roger said, reaching for another cigarette, "that I'd see something. You know, something. I couldn't believe it was as bad as it seemed. But the cumulative effect of those spots, it's like Jimmy Carter saying, 'I'll never lie to you.'" He took a drag from the new cigarette, grimaced, and stuffed it into the ashtray. "No wonder George Carlin and Steve Martin and fucking Saturday Night Live had a field day. That guy just looks so sanctimonious to me now. His voice had developed a sudden watery tremble. He shut his mouth with a snap. I've got an idea, Vic said quietly.
Yeah, you said something on the plane.
Roger looked at him, but without much hope.
If you got one, let's hear it.
I think the sharp serial professor has to make one more spot, Vic said. I think we have to convince old man Sharp of that. Not the kid, the old man.
What's the old prof gonna sell this time? Roger asked, twisting open another button on his shirt. Rat poison or Agent Orange?
Come on, Roger, no one got poisoned.
Might as well have, Roger said, and laughed shrilly. Sometimes I wonder if you understand what advertising really is. It's holding a wolf by the tail. Well, we lost our grip on this particular wolf, and he's just about to come back on us and eat us whole.
Roger.
This is the country where it's front page news when some consumer group weighed the McDonald's quarter pounder and found out it weighed a little shy of a quarter pound. Some obscure California magazine publishes a report that a rear-end collision can cause a gas tank explosion in Pintos, and the Ford Motor Company shakes in its shoes.
Don't get on that, Vic said, laughing a little. My wife's got a Pinto. I got problems enough.
All I'm saying is that getting the sharp serial professor to do another spot seems about as shrewd to me as having Richard Nixon do an encore State of the Union address. He's compromised, Vic. He's totally blown.
He paused, looking at Vic. Vic looked back at him gravely.
What do you want him to say?
That he's sorry. Roger blinked at him glassily for a moment. Then he threw back his head and cackled.
That he's sorry? Sorry? Oh, dear, that's wonderful. Was that your great idea?
Hold on, Rog. You're not even giving me a chance. That's not like you.
No, Roger said. I guess it's not. Tell me what you mean, but I can't believe you're
serious. I'm serious, all right. You took the courses. What's the basis of all successful advertising? Why bother to advertise at all?
The basis of all successful advertising is that people want to believe that people sell themselves.
Yeah. When the Maytag repairman says he's the loneliest guy in town, people want to believe that there really is such a guy someplace, not doing anything but listening to the radio and maybe jacking off once in a while. People want to believe that their Maytags will never need repairs. When Joe DiMaggio comes on and says Mr. Coffee, saves money, people want to believe that.
But isn't that why we've got our asses in a crack? They wanted to believe the sharp serial professor, and he let them down. Just like they wanted to believe in Nixon, and he...
Nixon, Vic said, surprised by his own angry vehemence.
You're getting blinded by that particular comparison. I've heard you make it 200 times since this thing blew, and it doesn't fit.
Roger was looking at him, stunned. Nixon was a crook. He knew he was a crook, and he said he wasn't a crook. The sharp cereal professor said there was nothing wrong with red raspberry zingers, and there was something wrong, but he didn't know it. Vic leaned forward and pushed his finger gently against Roger's arm, emphasizing. There was no breach of faith. He has to say that, Rog. He has to get up in front of the American people and tell them there was no breach of faith. What there was
there was a mistake made by a company which manufactures food dye. The mistake was not made by the Sharp Company. He has to say that. And most important of all, he has to say that he's sorry that mistake happened, and that although no one was hurt, he's sorry people were frightened.
Roger nodded, then shrugged. Yes, I see the thrust of it.
But neither the old man or the kid will go for it, Vic. They want to bury the Yes, Vic cried, actually making Roger flinch.
He jumped to his feet and began to walk jerkily up and down the screening room's short aisle.
Sure they do, and they're right. He's dead, and he has to be buried. The Sharp Serial Professor has to be buried. Zingers has already been buried. But the thing we've got to make them see is that it can't be a midnight burial. That's the exact point. Their impulse is to go at this thing like a mafia button man or a scared relative burying a cholera victim.
He leaned over Roger so close that their noses were almost touching.
Our job is to make them understand that the serial professor will never rest easy unless he's interred in broad daylight. And I'd like to make the whole country mourners at his burial.
You're crick,
Roger began, then closed his mouth with a snap. At long last, Vic saw that scared, vague impression go out of his partner's eyes. A sudden sharpening happened in Roger's face, and the scared expression was replaced by a slightly mad one. Roger began to grin. Vic was so relieved to see that grin that he forgot about Donna and what had happened with her for the first time since he had gotten Kemp's note. The job took over completely, and it was only later that he would wonder, slightly dumbfounded, how long it had been since he had felt that pure, trippy, wonderful feeling of being fully involved with something he was good at.
On the surface, we just want him to repeat the things Sharp has been saying since it happened, Vic went on. But when the serial professor himself says them,
it comes full circle, Roger murmured. He lit another cigarette.
Sure, right. We can maybe pitch it to the old man as the final scene in the Red Raspberry Zinger's farce. Coming clean, getting it behind us, taking the bitter medicine.
Sure, that'd appeal to the old goat. Public penance, scourging himself with whips.
And instead of going out like a dignified guy that took a pratfall in a mud puddle, everyone laughing at him, he goes out like Douglas MacArthur, saying old soldiers never die, they just fade away. That's the surface of the thing. But underneath, we're looking for a tone, a feeling.
He was crossing the border into Roger's country now. If he could only delineate the shape of what he meant, the idea that had come to him over coffee at Bentley's, Roger would take it from there.
MacArthur, Roger said softly.
But that's it, isn't it? The tone is farewell.
The feeling is regret.
Give people the feeling that he's been unjustly treated, but it's too late now.
And he looked at Vic almost startled.
What?
Prime time, Roger said.
Huh?
The spots. We run 'em in prime time.
These ads are for the parents, not the kids, right?
Yeah. If we ever get the damn things made.
Vic grinned.
We'll get them made.
And using one of Roger's terms for good ad copy,
it's a tank, Roger. We'll drive it right the fuck over them if we have to. as long as we can get something concrete down before we go to Cleveland. They sat and talked it over in the tiny screening room for another hour, and when they left to go back to the hotel, both of them sweaty and exhausted, it was full dark.
"Can we go home now, Mommy?"
Tad asked apathetically.
"Pretty soon, honey."
She looked at the key in the ignition switch, three other keys on the ring, house key, garage key, and the key that opened the Pinto's hatchback. There was a piece of leather attached to the ring with a mushroom branded on it. She had bought the key ring in Swanson's, a Bridgeton department store, back in April. Back in April, when she had been so disillusioned and scared, never knowing what real fear was. Real fear was trying to crank your kid's window shut while a rabid dog drooled on the back of your hands. She reached out. She touched the leather tab. She pulled her hand back again. The truth was this. She was afraid to try. It was 7:15. The day was still bright, although the Pinto shadow trailed out long, almost to the garage door. Although she did not know it, her husband and his partner were still watching kinescopes of the sharp serial professor at Image Eye in Cambridge. She didn't know why no one had answered the SOS she had been beeping out. In a book, someone would have come. It was the heroine's reward for having thought up such a clever idea. But no one had come. Surely the sound had carried down to the ramshackle house at the foot of the hill. Maybe they were drunk down there. Or maybe the owners of the two cars in the driveway. Dooryard, her mind corrected automatically. Up here they call it a dooryard. Had both gone off somewhere in a third car. She wished she could see that house from here, but it was out of sight beyond the descending flank of the hill. Finally, she had given the SOS up. She was afraid that if she kept tooting the horn, it would drain the Pinto's battery, which had been in since they got the car. She still believed the Pinto would start when the engine was cool enough. It always had before. But you're afraid to try. Because if it doesn't start, what then? She was reaching for the ignition again when the dog stumbled back into view. It had been lying out of sight in front of the Pinto. Now it moved slowly toward the barn, its head down and its tail drooping. It was staggering and weaving like a drunk near the bitter end of a long toot. Without looking back, Cujo slipped into the shadows of the building and disappeared. She drew her hand away from the key again.
"Mommy, aren't we going?"
"Let me think, hon," she said. She looked to her left, out the driver's side window. 8 running steps would take her to the back door of the Camber house. In high school, she had been the star of her high school girls' track team, and she still jogged regularly. She could beat the dog to the door, and inside, she was sure of that. There would be a telephone. One call to Sheriff Bannerman's office, and this horror would end. On the other hand, if she tried cranking the engine again, it might not start, but it would bring the dog on the run. She knew hardly anything about rabies, but she seemed to remember reading at some time or other that rabid animals were almost supernaturally sensitive to sounds. Loud noises could drive them into a frenzy.
"Mommy?"
"Shh, Tad. Shh." 8 running steps. Dig it. Even if Cujo was lurking and watching inside the garage just out of sight, she felt sure, she knew she could win a foot race to the back door. The telephone. Yes. And a man like Joe Camber surely kept a gun. Maybe a whole rack of them. What pleasure it would give her to blow that fucking dog's head to so much oatmeal and strawberry jam. 8 running steps. Sure,
dig on it a while. And what if that door giving on the porch was locked? Worth the risk? Her heart thudded heavily in her breast as she weighed the chances. If she had been alone, that would have been one thing. But suppose the door was locked. She could beat the dog to the door, but not to the door and then back to the car. Not if it came running, not if it charged her as it had done before. And what would Tad do? What if Tad saw his mother being ravaged by a 200-pound mad dog, being ripped and bitten, being pulled open? No, they were safe here. Try the engine again. She reached for the ignition, and part of her mind clamored that it would be safer to wait longer until the engine was perfectly cool. Perfectly cool? They had been here 3 hours or more already. She grasped the key and turned it. The engine cranked briefly, once, twice, 3 times, and then caught with a roar. Oh, thank God, she cried. Mommy, Tad asked shrilly, are we going? Are we going? We're going, she said grimly, and threw the transmission into reverse. Cujo lunged out of the barn, and then just stood there, watching. Fuck you, dog, she yelled at it triumphantly. She touched the gas pedal. The Pinto rolled back perhaps 2 feet and stalled. No, she screamed as the red idiot lights came on again. Cujo had taken another 2 steps when the engine cut out, but now he only stood there silently, his head down. Watching me, the thought occurred again. His shadow trailed out behind him, as clear as a silhouette cut out of black crepe paper. Donna fumbled for the ignition switch and turned it from on to start. The motor began to turn over again, but this time it didn't catch. She could hear a harsh panting sound in her own ears and didn't realize for several seconds that she was making the sound herself. In some vague way, she had the idea that it might be the dog. She ground the starter, grimacing horribly, swearing at it, oblivious of Tad, using words she had hardly known she knew. And all the time, Cujo stood there, trailing his shadow from his heels like some surreal funeral drape, watching. At last he lay down in the driveway, as if deciding there was no chance for them to escape. She hated it more then than she had when it had tried to force its way in through Tad's window. Mommy, mommy, mommy. From far away, unimportant. What was important now was this goddamned son-of-a-bitching little car. It was going to start. She was going to make it start by pure force of will. She had no idea how long, in real time, she sat hunched over the wheel with her hair hanging in her eyes, futilely grinding the starter. What at last broke through to her was not Tad's cries, they had trailed off to whimpers, but the sound of the engine. It would crank briskly for 5 seconds, then lag off, then crank briskly for another 5, then lag off again. A longer lag each time, it seemed. She was killing the battery. She stopped. She came out of it a little at a time, like a woman coming out of a faint. She remembered a bout of gastroenteritis she'd had in college. Everything inside her had either come up by the elevator or dropped down the chute. And near the end of it, she had grayed out in one of the dorm toilet stalls. Coming back had been like this, as if you were the same, but some invisible painter was adding color to the world, bringing it first up to full and then to overfull. Colors shrieked at you. Everything looked plastic and phony, like a display in a department store window. Swing into spring, perhaps, or ready for the first kickoff. Tad was cringing away from her, his eyes squeezed shut, the thumb of one hand in his mouth. The other hand was pressed against his hip pocket, where the monster words were. His respiration was shallow and rapid. "Tad," she said. "Honey, don't worry."
"Mommy, are you all right?"
His voice was little more than a husky whisper.
"Yeah, so are you.
At least we're safe. This old car will go. Just wait and see."
"I thought you were mad at me."
She took him in her arms and hugged him tight. She could smell sweat in his hair and the lingering undertone of Johnson's No More Tears shampoo. She thought of that bottle sitting safely and sanely on the second shelf of the medicine cabinet in the upstairs bathroom. If only she could touch it. But all that was here was that faint, dying perfume.
"No, honey, not at you," she said. "Never at you."
Tad hugged her back.
"He can't get us in here, can he?"
"No."
He can't eat his way in, can he?"
"No."
"I hate him," Tad said reflectively. "I wish he'd die."
"Yes, me too." She looked out the window and saw that the sun was getting ready to go down. A superstitious dread settled into her at the thought. She remembered the childhood games of hide-and-seek that had always ended when the shadows joined each other and grew into purple lagoons, that mystic call drifting through the suburban streets of her childhood, talismanic and distant, the high voice of a child announcing suppers that were ready, doors ready to be shut against the night.
"Ollie, ollie, and free! Ollie, ollie, and free!"
The dog was watching her. It was crazy, but she could no longer doubt it. Its mad, senseless eyes were fixed unhesitatingly on hers. "No, you're imagining it. It's only a dog, and a sick dog at that. Things are bad enough without you seeing something in that dog's eyes that can't be there." She told herself that. A few minutes later, she told herself that Cujo's eyes were like the eyes of some portraits, which seem to follow you wherever you move in the room where they are hung. But the dog was looking at her. And there was something familiar about it. "No," she told herself, and tried to dismiss the thought. But it was too late. "You've seen him before, haven't you? The morning after Tad had the first of his bad dreams, the morning that the blankets and sheets were back on his chair, his teddy on top of them. And for a moment when you opened the closet door, you only saw a slumped shape with red eyes, something in Tad's closet ready to spring. It was him. It was Cujo. Tad was right all along. Only the monster wasn't in his closet. It was out here. It was... stop it. Out here, just waiting to... You stop it, Donna!" She stared at the dog and imagined she could hear its thoughts. Simple thoughts. The same simple pattern repeated over and over in spite of the whirling boil of its sickness and delirium. "Kill the woman. Kill the boy. Kill the woman. Kill the..." "Stop it," she commanded herself roughly. It doesn't think, and it's not some goddamned boogeyman out of a child's closet. It's a sick dog, and that's all it is. Next, you'll believe the dog is God's punishment for committing...
Cujo suddenly got up, almost as if she had called him, and disappeared into the barn again.
Almost as if I called it.
She uttered a shaky, semi-hysterical laugh. Tad looked up.
Mummy? Nothing, hon.
She looked at the dark maw of the garage barn, then at the back door of the house.
Locked? Unlocked? Locked? Unlocked?
She thought of a coin rising in the air, flipping over and over. She thought of whirling the chamber drum of a pistol, 5 holes empty, 1 full.
Locked? Unlocked?
The sun went down, and what was left of the day was a white line painted on the western horizon. It looked no thicker than the white stripe painted down the center of the highway. That would be gone soon enough. Crickets sang in the high grass to the right of the driveway, making a mindlessly cheerful rickety-rickety sound. Cujo was still in the barn. Sleeping? She wondered. Eating? That made her remember that she had packed them some food. She crawled between the 2 front buckets and got the Snoopy lunchbox and her own brown bag. Her thermos had rolled all the way to the back, probably when the car had started to buck and jerk coming up the road. She had to stretch, her blouse coming untucked, before she could hook it with her fingers. Tad, who had been in a half doze, stirred awake. His voice was immediately filled with a sharp fright that made her hate the damn dog even more.
Mummy? Mummy? What are you?
Just getting the food, she soothed him. And my thermos, see?
Okay.
He settled back into his seat and put his thumb in his mouth again. She shook the big thermos gently beside her ear, listening for the grating sound of broken glass. She only heard milk swishing around inside. That was something, anyhow.
Tad, you want to eat?
I want to take a nap, he said around his thumb, not opening his eyes.
You gotta feed the machine, chum, she said.
He didn't even smile.
Not hungry. Sleepy.
She looked at him, troubled, and decided it would be wrong to force the issue any further. Sleep was Tad's natural weapon, maybe his only one, and it was already 30 minutes past his regular bedtime. Of course, if they had been home, he would have had a glass of milk and a couple of cookies before brushing his teeth, and a story, one of his Mercer Mayer books, maybe, and... She felt the hot sting of tears and tried to push all those thoughts away. She opened her thermos with shaky hands and poured herself 1/2 cup of milk. She set it on the dashboard and took one of the fig bars. After one bite, she realized she was absolutely ravenous. She ate 3 more fig bars, drank some milk, popped 4 or 5 of the green olives, then drained her cup. She burped gently, and then looked more sharply at the barn. There was a darker shadow in front of it now, except it wasn't just a shadow. It was the dog. It was Cujo.
He's standing watch over us.
No, she didn't believe that, nor did she believe she had seen a vision of Cujo in a pile of blankets stacked in her son's closet. She didn't, except part of her did. But that part wasn't in her mind. She glanced up into the rearview mirror at where the road was. It was too dark now to see it, but she knew it was there, just as she knew that nobody was going to go by. When they had come out that other time with Vic's Jag, all 3 of them, the dog was nice then, her brain muttered. The Tatter patted him and laughed, remember? Laughing it up and having a great old time, Vic had told her that until 5 years ago,
The Castle Rock dump had been out at the end of Town Road Number 3. Then the new waste treatment plant had gone into operation on the other side of town, and now, a quarter of a mile beyond the Camber place, the road simply ended at a place where a heavy chain was strung across it. The sign which hung from the chain read, "No trespassing, dump closed." Beyond Camber's, there was just no place to go. Donna wondered if maybe some people in search of a really private place to go parking might not ride by. But she couldn't imagine that even the horniest of local kids would want to neck at the old town dump. At any rate, no one had passed yet. The white line on the western horizon had faded to a bare afterglow now, and she was afraid that even that was mostly wishful thinking. There was no moon. Incredibly, she felt drowsy herself. Maybe sleep was her natural weapon, too. And what else was there to do? The dog was still out there. At least, she thought it was. The darkness had gotten just deep enough to make it hard to tell if that was a real shape or just a shadow. The battery had to rest. Then she could try again. So, why not sleep? The package on his mailbox. That package from J.C. Whitney. She sat up a little straighter, a puzzled frown creasing her brow. She turned her head, but from here the front corner of the house blocked her view of the mailbox. But she had seen the package hung from the front of the box. Why had she thought of that? Did it have some significance? She was still holding the Tupperware dish with the olives and slices of cucumbers inside, each wrapped neatly in saran wrap. Instead of eating anything else, she carefully put the white plastic cover on the Tupperware dish and stowed it back in Tad's lunchbox. She did not let herself think much about why she was being so careful of the food. She settled back in the bucket seat and found the lever that tipped it back. She meant to think about the package hooked over the mailbox. There was something there. She was almost sure of it. But soon her mind had slipped away to another idea, one that took on the bright tones of reality as she began to doze off. The Cambers had gone to visit relatives. The relatives were in some town that was 2, maybe 3 hours' drive away, Kennebunk maybe, or Hollis, or Augusta. It was a family reunion. Her beginning-to-dream mind saw a gathering of 50 people or more on a green lawn of TV commercial size and beauty. There was a fieldstone barbecue pit with a shimmer of heat over it. At a long trestle table, there were at least 4 dozen people passing platters of corn in the cob and dishes of home-baked beans, pea beans, soldier beans, red kidney beans. There were plates of barbecued franks. Donna's stomach made a low, goinging sound at this vision. On the table was a homely checked tablecloth. All this was being presided over by a lovely woman with pure white hair that had been rolled into a bun at the nape of her neck. Fully inserted into the capsule of her dream now, Donna saw with no surprise at all that this woman was her mother. The Cambers were there, but they weren't really the Cambers at all. Joe Camber looked like Vic in a clean Sears work coverall, and Mrs. Camber was wearing Donna's green watered silk dress. Their boy looked the way Tad was going to look when he was in 5th grade. "Mommy?" The picture wavered, started to break up. She tried to hold on to it because it was peaceful and lovely, the archetype of a family life she had never had. The type she and Vic would never have with their one planned child and their carefully programmed lives. With sudden rising sadness, she wondered why she had never thought of things in that light before. "Mommy?" The picture wavered again and began to darken. That voice from outside, piercing the vision the way a needle may pierce the shell of an egg. "Never mind. The Cambers were at their family reunion, and they would pull in later, around 10, happy and full of barbecue. Everything would be all right. The Joe Camber with Vic's face would take care of everything. Everything would be all right again.
There were some things that God never allowed. It would...
Mommy!
She came out of the doze, sitting up, surprised to find herself behind the wheel of the Pinto instead of at home in bed. But only for a second. Already the lovely, surreal image of the relatives gathered around the trestle picnic table was beginning to dissolve, and in 15 minutes she would not even remember that she had dreamed.
Huh? What?
Suddenly, shockingly, the phone inside the Camber's house began to ring. The dog rose to its feet, moving shadows that resolved themselves into its large and ungainly form.
Mommy, I have to go to the bathroom.
Cujo began to roar at the sound of the telephone. He was not barking, he was roaring. Suddenly, he charged at the house. He struck the back door hard enough to shake it in its frame.
No, she thought sickly. Oh, no, stop, please stop. Mommy, I have to...
The dog was snarling, biting at the wood of the door. She could hear the sick splintering sounds its teeth made.
Go, wee-wee.
The phone rang 6 times, 8 times, 10. Then it stopped. She realized she had been holding her breath. She let it out through her teeth in a low, hot sigh. Cujo stood at the door, his back paws on the ground, his forepaws on the top step. He continued to growl low in his chest, a hateful, nightmarish sound. At last, he turned and looked at the Pinto for a time. Donna could see the dried foam caked on his muzzle and chest. Then he padded back into the shadows and grew indistinct. It was impossible to tell exactly where he went. In the garage, maybe. Or maybe down the side of the barn. Tad was tugging desperately at the sleeve of her shirt.
Mommy, I have to go bad.
She looked at him helplessly. Brett Camber put the phone down slowly. No one answered. He's not home, I guess. Charity nodded, not terribly surprised. She was glad that Jim had suggested they make the call from his office, which was downstairs and off the family room. The family room was soundproofed. There were shelves of board games in there, a Panasonic large-screen TV with a video recorder, and an Atari video game setup attached to it. And standing in one corner was a lovely old Wurlitzer jukebox that really worked. Down at Gary's, I guess, Brett added disconsolately. Yes, I imagine he's with Gary, she agreed, which wasn't exactly the same as saying they were together at Gary's house. She had seen the faraway look that had come into Joe's eyes when she had finally struck the deal with him, the deal that had gotten her and her son down here. She hoped Brett wouldn't think of calling directory assistance for Gary Pervier's number, because she doubted if there would be any answer there, either. She suspected that there were 2 old dogs out somewhere tonight, howling at the moon.
Do you think Cooge is okay, Mom?
Why, I don't think your father would go off and leave him if he wasn't, she said. And that was true. She didn't believe he would. Why don't we leave it for tonight, and you call him in the morning? You ought to be getting to bed anyway. It's 10:00. You've had a big day.
I'm not tired.
Well, it's not good to go too long on nervous excitement. I put your toothbrush out, and your Aunt Holly put out a washcloth and a towel for you. Do you remember which bedroom?
Yeah, sure. You going to bed, Mom?
Soon. I'm going to sit up with Holly for a while. We've got a lot of history to catch up on, she and I.
Shyly, Brett said, She looks like you. You know that?
Charity looked at him, surprised.
Does she?
Yes, I suppose she does. A little.
And that little kid, Jimmy, He's got a real right hook. Pow! Brett burst out laughing.
Did he hurt your stomach?
Heck no.
Brett was looking around Jim's study carefully, noting the Underwood typewriter on the desk, the Rolodex, the neat open file of folders with the names on the tabs in alphabetical order. There was a careful, measuring look in his eyes that she couldn't understand or evaluate. He seemed to come back from far away.
Nah, he didn't hurt me. He's just a little kid.
He cocked his head at her.
My cousin, right?
Right.
Blood relation.
He seemed to muse over it. Brett, do you like your Uncle Jim and Aunt Holly?
I like her. I can't tell about him yet. That jukebox, that's really neat. But
he shook his head in a kind of impatience. What about it, Brett?
He takes so much pride in it, Brett said. That was the first thing he showed me, like a kid with a toy. Isn't this neat, you know?
Well, he's only had it for a little while, Charity said. An unformed dread had begun to swirl around inside of her, connected somehow with Joe. What had he told Brett when he took him out on the sidewalk?
Anyone's partial to something new.
Holly wrote me when they finally got it. Said Jim had wanted one of those things since he was a young man.
People, honey, different people buy different things to show themselves that they are successful, I suppose. There's no accounting for it, but usually it's something they couldn't have when they were poor.
Was Uncle Jim poor?
I really don't know, she said, but they are not poor now. All I meant was that he didn't have anything to do with it. You get what I mean?
He looked at her closely.
He bought it with money and hired some people to fix it and hired some more people to bring it here, and he says it's his, but he didn't, you know, he didn't, I don't know.
He didn't make it with his own hands? Although her fear was greater now, more coalesced, her voice was gentle.
Yeah. That's right. He bought it with money, but he didn't really have nothing to do.
Anything.
Okay, yeah, anything to do with it. But now he's, like, taken credit for it.
He said a jukebox is a delicate, complicated machine.
Dad could have gotten it running, Brett said flatly. And Charity thought she heard a door bang shut suddenly, closing with a loud, toneless, frightening bang. It wasn't in the house. It was in her heart. Dad would have tinkered it up, and it would have been his.
Brett, she said, and her voice sounded weak and justifying to her own ears. Not everybody is good at tinkering and fixing like your father is.
I know that, he said, still looking around the office.
Yeah.
But Uncle Jim shouldn't take credit for it just because he had the money, see? It's him taking the credit that I don't like. That bothers me.
She was suddenly furious with him. She wanted to take him by the shoulders and shake him back and forth, to raise her voice until it was loud enough to shout the truth into his brain. That money did not come by accident. That it almost always resulted from some sustained act of will. And that will was the core of character.
She would tell him that while his father was perfecting his skills as a tinkerer and swilling down Black Label with the rest of the boys in the back of Emerson's Sunoco, sitting in piles of dead bald tires and telling Frenchman jokes, Jim Brooks had been in law school, knocking his brains out to make grades. Because when you made the grades, you got the diploma, and the diploma was your ticket. You got to ride the merry-go-round. Getting on didn't mean you'd catch the brass ring, no, but it guaranteed you the chance to at least try.
"You go on up now and get ready for bed," she said quietly. "What you think of your Uncle Jim is between you and you. But give him a chance, Brett. Don't just judge him on that."
They had gone through into the family room now, and she jerked a thumb at the jukebox.
"No, I won't," he said.
She followed him up into the kitchen where Holly was making cocoa for the four of them. Jim Jr. and Gretchen had gone to bed long before.
"You get your man?" Holly asked.
"No, he's probably down chewing the fat with that friend of his," Charity said. "We'll try tomorrow."
"Want some cocoa, Brett?" Holly asked.
"Yes, please."
Charity watched him sit down at the table. She saw him put his elbow on it and then take it off again quickly, remembering that it was impolite. Her heart was so full of love and hope and fear that it seemed to stagger in her chest.
"Time," she thought. "Time and perspective. Give him that. If you force him, you'll lose him for sure."
But how much time was there? Only a week, and then he would be back under Joe's influence. And even as she sat down next to her son and thanked Holly for her cup of hot cocoa, her thoughts had turned speculatively to the idea of divorce again. In her dream, Vic had come. He simply walked down the driveway to the Pinto and opened her door. He was dressed in his best suit, the three-piece charcoal gray one. When he put it on, she always teased him that he looked like Jerry Ford with hair.
"Come on, you two," he said,
and that quirky little grin on his face.
"Time to go home before the vampires come out."
She tried to warn him, to tell him the dog was rabid, but no words came. And suddenly Cujo was advancing out of the dark, his head down, a steady low growl rumbling in his chest. "Watch out!" she tried to cry. "His bite is death!" But no sound came out.
But just before Cujo launched himself at Vic, he turned and pointed his finger at the dog.
Cujo's fur went dead white instantly. His red rheumy eyes dropped back into his head like marbles into a cup. His muzzle fell off and shattered against the crushed gravel of the driveway like black glass. A moment later, all that was left in front of the garage was a blowing fur coat.
"Don't you worry," Vic said in the dream. "Don't you worry about that old dog. It's nothing but a fur coat. Did you get the mail yet?" "Never mind the dog. The mail's coming. The mail's the important thing, right? The mail."
His voice was disappearing down a long tunnel, growing echoey and faint. And suddenly, it was not a dream of Vic's voice, but a memory of a dream. She was awake, and her cheeks were wet with tears. She had cried in her sleep. She looked at her watch and could just make out the time, 1:15. She looked over at Tad and saw he was sleeping soundly, his thumb hooked into his mouth.
"Never mind the dog. The mail's coming. The mail's the important thing."
And suddenly the significance of the package hung over the mailbox door came to her, hit her like an arrow fired up from her subconscious mind, an idea she had not quite been able to get hold of before. Perhaps because it was so big, so simple, so elementary, my dear Watson.
Yesterday was Monday, and the mail had come. The J.C. Whitney package for Joe Camber was ample proof of that. Today was Tuesday, and the mail would come again. Tears of relief began to roll down her not-yet-dry cheeks. She actually had to restrain herself from shaking Tad awake and telling him it was going to be all right, that by 2 o'clock this afternoon at the latest, and more probably by 10 or 11 in the morning, if the mail delivery out here was as prompt as it was most other places in town, this nightmare would end. The mailman would come, even if he had no mail for the Cambers. That was the beauty of it. It would be his job to see if the flag was up, signifying outgoing mail. He would have to come up here, to his last stop on Town Road Number 3, to check that out. And today, he was going to be greeted by a woman who was semi-hysterical with relief. She eyed Tad's lunchbox and thought of the food inside. She thought of herself carefully saving some of it aside in case, well, in case. Now it didn't matter so much, although Tad was likely to be hungry in the morning. She ate the rest of the cucumber slices. Tad didn't care for cucumbers much anyway. It would be an odd breakfast for him, she thought, smiling. Fig bars, olives, and a Slim Jim or two. Munching the last two or three cucumber slices, she realized it was the coincidences that had scared her the most. That series of coincidences, utterly random, but mimicking a kind of sentient fate, had been what seemed to make the dog so horribly purposeful, so out to get her personally. Vic being gone for 10 days, that was coincidence number one. Vic calling early today, that was coincidence number two. If he hadn't got them then, he would have tried later, kept trying, and begun to wonder where they were. The fact that all three of the Cambers were gone, at least for overnight, the way it looked now, that was number three. Mother, son, and father, all gone. But they had left their dog. Oh, yes, they had. A sudden horrible thought occurred to her, freezing her jaws on the last bite of cucumber. She tried to thrust it away, but it came back. It wouldn't go away because it had its own gargoyle-like logic. What if they were all dead in the barn? The image rose behind her eyes in an instant. It had the unhealthy vividness of those waking visions which sometimes come in the morning's small hours, the three bodies tumbled about like badly made toys on the floor in there, the sawdust around them stained red, their dusty eyes staring up into the blackness where barn swallows cooed and fluttered, their clothing ripped and chewed, parts of them. Oh, that's crazy. That's. Maybe he had gotten the boy first. The other two are in the kitchen, or maybe upstairs having a quickie. They hear the screams, they rush out. Stop it, won't you stop it? They rush out, but the boy is already dead. The dog has torn his throat out. And while they're still stunned by the death of their son, the St. Bernard comes lurching out of the shadows, old and terrible engine of destruction. Yes, the old monster comes from the shadows, rabid and snarling. He goes for the woman first, and the man tries to save her. No. He would have gotten his gun, or brained it with a wrench or something, and where's the car? There was a car here before they all went off on a family trip. Do you hear me? Family trip. Took the car, left the truck. Then why had no one come to feed the dog? That was the logic of the thing, part of what frightened her. Why hadn't anyone come to feed the dog? Because if you were going to be away for a day or for a couple of days, you made an arrangement with somebody. They fed your dog for you, and then when they were gone, you feed their cat for them, or their fish, or their parakeet, or whatever. So where? And the dog kept going back into the barn. Was it eating in there? That's the answer, her mind told her, relieved. He didn't have anyone to feed the dog, so he poured it a tray of food, Gaines meal or something. But then she stuck upon what Joe Camber himself had stuck upon earlier on that long, long day. A big dog would gobble it all at once and then go hungry. Surely it would be better to get a friend to feed the dog if you were going to be gone. On the other hand, maybe they had been held up. Maybe there really had been a family reunion, and Camber had gotten drunk and passed out. Maybe this, maybe that, maybe anything. Is the dog eating in the barn? What is it eating in there? Gaines' meal or people? She spat the last of the cucumber into her cupped hand and felt her stomach roll, wanting to send up what she had already eaten. She set her will upon keeping it down, and because she could be very determined when she wanted to, she did keep it down. They had left the dog some food and had gone off in the car. You didn't have to be Sherlock Holmes to deduce that. The rest of it was nothing but a bad case of the willies. But that image of death kept trying to creep back in. The dominant image was the bloody sawdust, sawdust which had gone the dark color of natural casing Frank's. Stop. Think about the mail if you have to think about anything. Think about tomorrow. Think about being safe. There was a soft, scuffling, scratching noise on her side of the car. She didn't want to look, but was helpless to stop herself. Her head began to turn as if forced by invisible yet powerful hands. She could hear the low creak of the tendons in her neck. Cujo was there, looking in at her. His face was less than 6 inches from her own. Only the safety glass of the driver's side window separated them. Those red, bleary eyes stared into hers. The dog's muzzle looked as if it had been badly lathered with shaving cream that had been left to dry. Cujo was grinning at her. She felt a scream building in her chest, coming up in her throat like iron, because she could feel the dog thinking at her, telling her, "I'm going to get you, babe. I'm going to get you, kiddo. Think about the mailman all you want to. I'll kill him too if I have to, the way I killed all three of the Cambers, the way I'm going to kill you and your son. You might as well get used to the idea. You might as well." The scream coming up in her throat. It was a live thing struggling to get out, and everything was coming on her at once. Tad having to pee, she had unrolled his window 4 inches and held him up so he could do it out the window, watching all the time for the dog. And for a long time he hadn't been able to go, and her arms had begun to ache. Then the dream. Then the images of death. And now this. The dog was grinning in at her. He was grinning in at her. Cujo was his name, and his bite was death. The scream had to come. But Tad's, or she would go mad, sleeping. She locked her jaws against the scream the way she had locked her throat against the urge to vomit a few moments ago. She struggled with it. She fought it. And at last her heart began to slow down, and she knew she had it licked. She smiled at the dog and raised both of her middle fingers from closed fists. She held them against the glass, which was now slightly fogged on the outside with Cujo's breath. "Go get fucked," she whispered. After what seemed an endless time, the dog put its forepaws down and went back into the barn. Her mind turned down that same dark track again. What's it eating in there? And then she slammed a door shut somewhere in her mind. But there would be no more sleep, not for a long time, and it was so long until dawn.
She sat upright behind the wheel, trembling, telling herself over and over again that it was ridiculous, really ridiculous, to feel that the dog was some kind of hideous revenant which had escaped from Tad's closet, or that it knew more about the situation than she did. Vic jerked awake in total darkness, rapid breath as dry as salt in his throat. His heart was trip-hammering in his chest, and he was totally disoriented, so disoriented that for a moment he thought he was falling and reached out to clutch the bed. He closed his eyes for a moment, forcibly holding himself together, making himself coalesce. "You are in?" He opened his eyes and saw a window, a bedstand, a lamp. The Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Boston, Massachusetts. He relaxed. That reference point given, everything came together with a reassuring click, making him wonder how he could have been so lost and totally apart, even momentarily. It was being in a strange place, he supposed. That and the nightmare. Nightmare. Jesus, it had been a beaut. He couldn't remember having had such a bad one since the falling dreams that had plagued him off and on during early puberty. He reached for the travelette clock on the nightstand, gripped it in both hands, and brought it close to his face. It was 2:40. Roger was snoring lightly in the other bed, and now that his eyes had adjusted to the dark, he could see him, sleeping flat on his back. He had kicked the sheet over the end of the bed. He was wearing an absurd pair of pajamas covered with small yellow college pennants. Vic swung his legs out of bed, went quietly into the bathroom, and closed the door. Roger's cigarettes were on the washstand, and he helped himself to one. He needed it. He sat on the toilet and smoked, tapping ashes into the sink. An anxiety dream, Donna would have said, and God knew he had enough to be anxious about. Yet he had gone to bed around 10:30 in better spirits than he had been in for the last week. After arriving back at the hotel, he and Roger had spent half an hour in the Ritz-Carlton's bar, kicking the apology idea around. And then, from the bowels of the huge old wallet he hauled around, Roger produced the home number of Yancey Harrington. Harrington was the actor who played the sharp serial professor. "Might as well see if he'll do it before we go any further," Roger said. He had picked up the phone and dialed Harrington, who lived in Westport, Connecticut. Vic hadn't known just what to expect. If pressed for his best guess, he would have said that probably Harrington would have to be stroked a little. He had been just miserable over the Zingers affair and what he considered it had done to his image. Both of them had been in for a happy surprise. Harrington had agreed instantly. He recognized the realities of the situation and knew the professor was pretty well finished. "Poor old guy's a gone goose," Harrington had said glumly. But he thought the final ad might be just the thing to get the company over the affair, put it back on the rails, so to speak. "Bullshit," Roger said, grinning after he had hung up. "He just likes the idea of one final curtain call. Not many actors in advertising get a chance like that. He'd buy his own plane ticket to Boston if we asked him to." So Vic had gone to bed happy and had fallen asleep almost instantly. Then the dream. He was standing in front of Tad's closet door in the dream and telling Tad that there was nothing in there, nothing at all. "I'll show you once and for all," he told Tad. He opened the closet door and saw that Tad's clothes and toys were gone. There was a forest growing in Tad's closet, old pines and spruces, ancient hardwoods. The closet floor was covered with fragrant needles and leafy mulch. He had scraped at it, wanting to see if the floor of painted boards was beneath. It wasn't. His foot scraped up rich black forest earth instead. He stepped into the closet and the door closed behind him. That was all right. There was enough light to see by. He found a trail and began to hike along it. All at once he realized there was a pack on his back and a canteen slung over one shoulder.
He could hear the mysterious sound of the wind soughing through the firs and faint birdsong. 7 years ago, long before AdWorks, they had all gone hiking on part of the Appalachian Trail during one of their vacations, and that land had looked a good deal like the geography of his dream. They had done it only that once, sticking to the seacoast after that. Vic, Donna, and Roger had had a wonderful time, but Althea Breakstone loathed hiking and had come down with a good itchy case of poison oak on top of that. The first part of the dream had been rather pleasant. The thought that all this had been right inside Tad's closet was, in its own strange way, wonderful. Then he had come into a clearing, and he had seen, but it was already beginning to tatter, the way dreams do when they are exposed to waking thought. The other side of the clearing had been a sheer gray wall, rising maybe 1,000 feet into the sky. About 20 feet up, there was a cave. No, not really deep enough to be a cave. It was more of a niche, just a depression in the rock that happened to have a flat floor. Donna and Tad were cowering inside, cowering from some sort of monster that was trying to reach up and then reach in, get them, eat them. It had been like that scene in the original King Kong after the great ape has shaken Fay Wray's would-be rescuers from the log and is trying to get the lone survivor. But the guy has gotten into a hole and Kong isn't quite able to get him. The monster in his dream hadn't been a giant ape, though. It had been a... what? Dragon? No, nothing like that. Not a dragon. Not a dinosaur. Not a troll. He couldn't get it. Whatever it was, it couldn't quite get in and get Donna and Tad, so it was merely waiting outside their bolt hole, like a cat waiting with dreadful patience for a mouse. He began to run, but no matter how fast he went, he never got any closer to the other side of the clearing. He could hear Donna screaming for help, but when he called back, his words seemed to die 2 feet out of his mouth. It was Tad who had finally spotted him.
"They don't work!"
Tad had screamed in a hopeless, despairing voice that had hollowed out Vic's guts with fear.
"Daddy, the monster words don't work. Oh, Daddy, they don't work. They never worked. You lied, Daddy. You lied."
He ran on, but it was as if he were on a treadmill, and he had looked at the base of that high gray wall and had seen a heaped drift of old bones and grinning skulls, some of them furred with green moss. That was when he woke up. What had that monster been, anyway? He just couldn't remember. Already the dream seemed like a scene observed through the wrong end of a telescope. He dropped the cigarette into the john, flushed it, and ran water into the sink as well to swirl the ashes down the drain. He urinated, shut off the light, and went back to bed. As he lay down, he glanced at the telephone and felt a sudden irrational urge to call home. Irrational? That was putting it mildly. It was 2:50 in the morning. He would not only wake her up, he would probably scare the living hell out of her in the bargain. You didn't interpret dreams literally. Everyone knew that. When both your marriage and your business seemed in danger of running off the rails at the same time, it wasn't really surprising that your mind pulled a few unsettling head games, was it? Still, just to hear her voice and know she's okay. He turned away from the telephone, punched up the pillow, and resolutely shut his eyes. "Call her in the morning, if that'll make you feel better. Call her right after breakfast." That eased his mind, and very shortly he drifted off to sleep again. This time he did not dream, or if he did, these dreams never imprinted themselves on his conscious mind. And when the wake-up call came on Tuesday, he had forgotten all about the dream of the beast in the clearing. He had only the vaguest recollection of having gotten up in the middle of the night at all. Vic did not call home that day.
Charity Camber awoke that Tuesday morning on the dot of 5 and went through her own brief period of disorientation. Yellow wallpaper instead of wood walls, colorful green print curtains instead of white chintz, a narrow single bed instead of the double that had begun to sag in the middle. Then she knew where she was, Stratford, Connecticut, and felt a burst of pleased anticipation. She would have the whole day to talk to her sister, to hash over old times, to find out what she had been doing the last few years. And Holly had talked about going into Bridgeport to do some shopping. She had awakened an hour and a half before her usual time, probably 2 hours or more before things began to stir in this household. But a person never slept well in a strange bed until the third night. That had been one of her mother's sayings, and it was a true one. The silence began to give up its little sounds as she lay awake and listening, looking at the thin 5 o'clock light that fell between the half-drawn curtains. Dawn's early light, always so white and clear and fine. She heard the creak of a single board, a blue jay having its morning tantrum, the day's first commuter train bound for Westport, Greenwich, and New York City. The board creaked again. And again. It wasn't just the house settling, it was footsteps. Charity sat up in bed, the blanket and sheet pooling around the waist of her sensible pink nightgown. Now the steps were going slowly downstairs. It was a light tread, bare feet or sock feet. It was Brett. When you lived with people, you got to know the sound of their walk. It was one of those mysterious things that just happen over a course of years, like the shape of a leaf sinking into a rock. She pushed the covers back, got up, and went to the door. Her room opened on the upstairs hall, and she just saw the top of Brett's head disappearing, his cowlick sticking up for a moment, and then gone. She went after him. When Charity reached the top of the stairs, Brett was just disappearing down the hallway that ran the width of the house, from the front door to the kitchen. She opened her mouth to call him, and then shut it again. She was intimidated by the sleeping house that wasn't her house. Something about the way he had been walking, the set of his body, but it had been years since... She descended the stairs quickly and quietly in her bare feet. She followed Brett into the kitchen. He was dressed only in light blue pajama bottoms, their white cotton drawstring hanging down to below the neat fork of his crotch. Although it was barely midsummer, he was already very brown. He was naturally dark, like his father, and tanned easily. Standing in the doorway, she saw him in profile, that same fine, clear morning light pouring over his body, as he hunted along the line of cupboards above the stove and the counter and the sink. Her heart was full of wonder and fear. "He's beautiful," she thought. "Everything that's beautiful or ever was in us is in him." It was a moment she never forgot. She saw her son clad only in his pajama bottoms, and for a moment dimly comprehended the mystery of his boyhood, so soon to be left behind. Her mother's eyes loved the slim curve of his muscles, the line of his buttocks, the clean soles of his feet. He seemed utterly perfect. She saw it clearly because Brett wasn't awake. As a child, there had been episodes of sleepwalking, about 2 dozen of them in all, between the ages of 4 and 8. She had finally gotten worried enough, scared enough, to consult with Dr. Gresham, without Joe's knowledge. She wasn't afraid that Brett was losing his mind. Anyone who was around him could see he was bright and normal. But she was afraid that he might hurt himself while he was in that strange state. Dr. Gresham had told her that was very unlikely, and that most of the funny ideas people had about somnambulism came from cheap, badly researched movies. "We only know a little about sleepwalking," he had told her, "but we do know that it is more common in children than it is in adults.
There's a constantly growing, constantly maturing interaction between the mind and body, Mrs. Camber, and a lot of people who have done research in this field believe that sleepwalking may be a symptom of a temporary and not terribly significant imbalance between the two.
Like growing pains? She had asked doubtfully.
Very much like that, Gresham had said with a grin.
He drew a bell curve on his office pad, suggesting that Brett's somnambulism would reach a peak, hold for a while, then begin to taper off. Eventually, it would disappear. She had gone away a little reassured by the doctor's conviction that Brett would not go sleepwalking out a window or down the middle of a highway, but without being much enlightened. A week later, she had brought Brett in. He had been just a month or two past his 6th birthday then. Gresham had given him a complete physical and had pronounced him normal in every way. And indeed, Gresham had appeared to be right. The last of what Charity thought of as his night walks had occurred more than 2 years ago. The last, that was, until now. Brett opened the cupboards one by one, closing each neatly before going on to the next, disclosing Holly's casserole dishes, the extra elements to her Gen Air range, her dish towels neatly folded, her coffee and tea creamer, her as-yet-incomplete set of depression glassware. His eyes were wide and blank, and she felt a cool certainty that he was seeing the contents of other cabinets in another place. She felt the old helpless terror that she had almost completely forgotten as parents do the alarms and the excursions of their children's early years, the teething, the vaccination that brought the frighteningly high fever as a little extra added attraction, the croup, the ear infection, the hand or leg that suddenly began to spray irrational blood. What's he thinking? She wondered. Where is he? And why now, after 2 quiet years? Was it being in a strange place? He hadn't seemed unduly upset, at least not until now. He opened the last cupboard and took down a pink gravy boat. He put it on the counter. He picked up empty air and mimed pouring something into the gravy boat. Her arms suddenly broke out in goose flesh as she realized where he was and what this dumb show was all about. It was a routine he went through each day at home. He was feeding Cujo. She took an involuntary step toward him and then stopped. She didn't believe those wives' tales about what might happen if you woke a sleepwalker, that the soul would be forever shut out of the body, that madness might result, or sudden death. And she hadn't needed Dr. Gresham to reassure her on that score. She had gotten a book on special loan from the Portland City Library. But she hadn't really needed that, either. Her own good common sense told her that what happened when you woke up a sleepwalker was that they woke up. No more and no less than just that. There might be tears, even mild hysteria, but that sort of reaction would be provoked by simple disorientation. Still, she had never wakened Brett during one of his night walks, and she didn't dare do so now. Good common sense was one thing. Her unreasoning fear was another, and she was suddenly very afraid and unable to think why. What could be so dreadful in Brett's acted-out dream of feeding his dog? It was perfectly natural, as worried as he had been about Cujo. He was bent over now, holding the gravy boat out, the drawstring of his pajama trousers making a right-angled white line to the horizontal plane of the red and black linoleum floor. His face went through a slow-motion pantomime of sorrow. He spoke then, muttering the words as sleepers so often do, gutturally, rapidly, almost unintelligibly, and with no emotion in the words themselves. That was all inside, held in the cocoon of whatever dream had been vivid enough to make him nightwalk again after 2 quiet years.
There was nothing inherently melodramatic about the words, spoken all of a rush in a quick, sleeping sigh. But Charity's hand went to her throat anyway. The flesh there was cold. Cold. "Cujo's not hungry no more," Brett said, the words riding out on that sigh. He stood up again, now holding the gravy boat cradled to his chest. "Not no more, not no more,"